last but not least for the day, Kevin Costa will be talking now on trying to relate some of the detailed analysis you've been thinking about, all the way from the molecule to the cell to food tissue to saying, well, where's the beef here in terms of how do we relate this to real world and real people, patients,
Thanks a lot, Leon, and to the organizers for inviting me to be here. It's been a real exciting conference so far. And I have to say, there was a little miscommunication because I came in yesterday morning. I don't usually have these parenthetical titles on my talks. And I came in yesterday morning, and I ran into Teo first thing in the morning. And I said, oh, how are you doing? You know, well, nervous, I have to say, and right after you and right after Andrew, that's a tough act to follow. And, you know, being the sort of nurturing and fatherly guy that we all know Teo is, he looked at me with a smile and said, you're in trouble. So we'll see what happens. But this talk is going to be, as Leon said, talking about a couple of different projects where we're involved. This is the group at Columbia, the Cardiac Biomechanics Group. Involves MDs, PhDs, medicine and surgery, some of the students. And Alistair mentioned that in New Zealand there's not a lot of people around, so they kind of have to talk to each other. In New York, we talk to each other also. It's kind of the opposite reason. We're so cramped in with each other, we really don't have much of a choice. But sometimes it actually works out in a positive way. And I think what I'll be able to show you today is some cases where it has. So last talk, on the second to the last day, I don't have to go into a lot of details here, but these are the kinds of clinical motivations that we use when in motivating the research that we're doing. We're ultimately trying to help patients that have heart disease, either by understanding basic mechanisms or by trying to impact our clinical practice. And so in the literature, sometimes you see things like this, Newsweek a couple of years ago, how technology will heal your heart. And so I started thinking about this at one of the lab meetings one day. We were talking about how has biomechanics impacted clinical treatment for heart disease. And we looked at some of the areas of bioengineering and medical imaging. We had denoising, segmentation, some of the exciting techniques we've seen at this conference. In the electrophysiology world, ECG analysis, pacemakers, defibrillators, surgical implants. There's a lot of exciting work going on in that area where engineering is impacting patients' lives. And in tissue engineering, while these living replacements aren't available currently, there's great promise to be able to replace damaged tissues with living replacements. And then we thought about cardiac mechanics and said, so how's this impacting things? And it was a little sobering, I think. We couldn't, certainly biomechanics impact some of the implants and interpreting MR tagging, but it was tough to kind of put a finger on a specific advancement that had been made. And so we started thinking, why is this? So what are we thinking about when we're thinking about cardiac mechanics and the engineering analysis of myocardial mechanics? Here we have an example of these X-ray opaque, radio opaque markers that are planted in the dog heart. This is from Jeff Ullman's work. And we can do some continuum mechanics and measure from sort of the set of beads that's in the ventricle, measure the components of strain, and look at both the normal strains and the shear strains, which Julius did a good job showing everybody what exactly that meant. And in my thesis work, I was interested in understanding how this was related to the underlying tissue structure. I was at UCSD at the time that Ian LeGrice was doing his postdoc there. He's the one that kind of introduced me to the sheet laminar architecture. And I very much enjoyed the time learning from him and understanding how this structure impacts tissue mechanics. And so, one of the things that we did for the first time was identify a local sort of natural coordinate system that was aligned with the natural structural axes of these myocardial laminae. And through some simple continuum mechanics, you can transform your strain tensor in cardiac coordinates, circumferential, longitudinal, and radial, into something that we thought was more reflective of what was actually going on in these layers of tissue. And I'm not going to get into a lot of the details of this at the moment, but the idea was that we found that whereas the shear strains in particular are very small in cardiac coordinates, when you look in shear coordinates, there was this big component that kind of popped out at you. And this had to do with these layers of tissue sliding over one another. And it was very consistent with the model that Ian had suggested about how these layers of tissue could contribute to wall thickening by shearing of these planes and then rotating towards the radial axis and therefore contributing to wall thickening. And so I'm going to take a little caveat here. And since this is getting into tissue-related issues, Leon suggested, well, why don't you just put a little bit of tissue-related issues into your talk? And so I did that, and here we have some tissue-level issues. So one of the questions is, when we first were working on this, is this even real? Are these structures even real, or is it just some sort of artifact of sectioning? And I think based on all the work that's been shown here today, I think there's no question about the fact that they are real structures. But at the time, we sort of had to spend some time proving that to ourselves, and of course, the beautiful work that's come out of Auckland recently leaves no doubt that this is a real structure. I'm going to break out of this PowerPoint presentation for a minute because I was just kind of fooling around with something, and I thought it was revealing as far as how this structure might arise. This is just a stack of images in NIH image. And as you can see, the orientation of these things changes, if you want to call that the endocardium, and they increment in 5-degree increments. They call that mid-wall, the horizontal, and this is epicardium, and the white page there is the epicardium. And so if you have a structure like this, and you take a slice through it, which is what we're doing when we do the sectioning, what does that look like? Well, if you do this over on the edge over here, turns out that it looks remarkably like sheet structures that Ian has proposed. They have this sort of sinusoidal orientation. They change even to this U shape towards the base. And if you pop over to the other side of this structure and do the same thing, and in both of these, the epicardium is to the right on these transverse sections. You see that the orientation is sort of oppositely directed depending on where you are relative to these to this helical structure, to this layered structure. You can also do some, and this would be short axis plane. Hold on a moment. I would have made some kind of movie of this if I had discovered it sooner. But this would be one orientation. Is it chevron shaped like we see in the short axis? Well, maybe not, but it also does have some kind of, geometry like that. And if you do it at the bottom, I'm not going to do it. It sort of has the same kind of pattern, but the reverse orientation. And so when Van showed these wonderful diffusion images of intersecting, fibers and things like this, and you wonder how the hell does this all integrate together and how is it compatible with this transmural fiber distribution, it's interesting to see that just from a pattern perspective, it looks like if you have these layered orientations that change direction like this, that even if there is no sheet structure, if you make a cut, then just the layers give you this kind of an orientation. So I thought that was kind of interesting, and I don't know what it means exactly, but I figured that maybe you guys would be able to help me figure it out. So the tissue is real, let's see.
Yep.
Yes.
Would you just go back to the previous slide?
This one,
the one that had the conical bone.
Yeah.
So I would certainly agree with you. The sheet structure exists. Do you think it exists everywhere within the myocardium?
Well, there are some regions where the structure is clearly different. The epicardium is much more compacted, and in the endocardium, there's some differences as well. And clearly, what I showed you with that very simple illustration is not what's going on. But it's also not incompatible with the idea that when you have a transmural distribution of fiber orientation that's
similar to what you have in the heart, that you get these kinds of patterns. Now, one thing I didn't show you, when in that simulation, I was just kind of simple about it, and I kept everything concentric. So there was actually a point in the center where everything is rotating around. That isn't really the case, I don't think, if you could find a point like that in the heart, in the myocardium. So I also kind of messed around a little bit with displacing those kind of randomly relative to one another. And you get sort of similar structures, but not as clean breaks and everything. And you know whether or not that is that has to occur in order to see sort of these dual orientations of structures, or if it has anything to do with this, I don't know. I thought it was I was kind of surprised by it. So the second thing, what about these laminar? What's going on at the level of the tissues? Laminar sheets, do they deform with the myocardium? Sponitz in the 70s showed some direct evidence that suggested that as the heart is deflated, the pressure goes down, the wall thickness increases, and you see that the orientation of these cleavage planes tends to reorient. And this is what we sort of tried to embody when we did our strain analysis. Again, the idea here is not for you to understand the details of all these strains, or it's sort of too complicated for this, but the principal idea is that there were some consistencies in the different locations that we looked at the apex and at the base. In particular, the shears that seemed to be important were, this is my muscle fibers, they're kind of attached like this. Spreading of the muscle fibers within the sheet was a large component. Shearing of muscle fibers within sheets like this was actually very small, this tight coupling of the myocytes with respect to one another. But when you have multiple layers, they can move either relative to one another like this or relative to one another like this. Both of those modes exist. And that's what's being described here by the green lines and the red lines being much bigger than the blue. The blue is the in-plane stuff, and they're kind of stuck together. So what at a cellular level might be giving rise, you know, what's the potential functional role of this? I already mentioned Ian's idea of the sheets rotating towards the radial axis. It turns out if you look at that not in cardiac coordinates but in sheet coordinates, that is accentuated. We see a rotation towards the radial direction as well as this extension along the sheet, and both of those contribute. If we look at the radial strain, E3-3, both those, so sheet extension, that's an important contributor, and sheet shear, that's an important contributor to radial strain. The sheet normal strain, so that actually causes thinning of the sheets. What might happen if you have thinning and extension of sheets? Well, it looks like there's potentially two structural ways to arrive at something like that. If this is supposed to be a typical sheet, four cells across, at end diastole, here's one boundary, here's another boundary, and we're saying that these things are extending in this direction, and they're getting thinner, then it seems like one of two things has, or some combination of these two things has to be happening. One is that the myocytes go from sort of roundish to more elliptical in cross-section, or the alternative is that they stay roundish, but they kind of interdigitate. And based on some anatomical studies back in the 40s, I don't think it was Streeter, I can't remember who did the measurements, actually counted the number of myocytes from endocardium to epicardium. It turns out that the number of myocytes actually increases if you draw a line from endocardium to epicardium and measure the number of cells that you interact with at end diastole and at end systole. So there does seem to be some reorganization of cells towards, rearrangement of cells towards the radial direction. And it would be great if, you know, diffusion imaging or confocal or somehow we could have the resolution to look at what's going on at this very small level and see if we can resolve what potential ways this could occur.
Kevin, do sheets move completely independently of each other, or is there force transduction from sheet to sheet?
There's no reason to think there wouldn't be force transduction and compression. And then in tension, there are long collagen fibers in between, so maybe if they're pressed up against each other when they start to separate, they don't, but then they do engage. Even this stuff, I'm kind of making it up in my head. If the tissue is in vivo, you know, I think there's swelling and stuff that the cleavage planes that you see in fixed tissues are not as pronounced as when they're in the natural tissues. And so, I think definitely there's force transmission. Yeah, but Teo's comment that the shear stress is minimized, I think that's what we end up seeing, because the shear strains are so high between these planes of tissue, the shear stresses are relieved, and we know that in general, large shear stresses is a failure mechanism in most mechanical materials, and if you can minimize shear stresses, you can undergo much more complex deformations without inducing injury or some other kind of failure mechanism, perhaps. Yeah?
Yeah, I sort of interpreted Ian's model as a failure of the Phoenician blind. It sort of starts in a closed position, and if you go across through it, you know, you count how many things you run into, you know, in terms of cells, you know, per unit length. If you now open the blinds by changing the angle, you know, they're not really going, but because they could slip in that direction, you now have a much thicker space, and assuming things, you know, move together to make up fill in the gaps. If you then count the number of cells across, you can get more cells across the wall, but you haven't had to rearrange anything other than just to slip one sheet over the other. It's highly simplified.
That may be, and honestly, the we're measuring strains here on the order of that have a resolution on the order of millimeters to a centimeter. You know, I guess it's better than a centimeter, but it's a region of tissue that is large compared to the size of the sheets. And so, this is, like I said, this is in my head, and this is what we're thinking. I'm thinking might be mechanisms for how this is manifesting, but there may be other things that are going on. Sheets, instead of getting thinner, they could come closer together to one another, and at a macroscopic scale, that might be manifest as a negative ENN as well. So, like I said, this is some ideas that we need ways to validate, and there aren't really good techniques to see this in living, breathing tissue at the moment. Laminar structure suggests orthotropic material properties. Alistair said that they use this Costa law, and I feel a little funny about that. Really, that's just the Fung law that I used in my thesis, which is easier to say. It looks something like this, and Ian has done some nice testing of chunks of myocardium in shear to try and extract some of the coefficients that impact shear deformation. Some of Andrew's work, he talked about the fact that if you add transverse active tension, that's an important factor in reproducing measured three-dimensional strains in the myocardium. It turns out if you add orthotropy, that has sort of a second-order effect. It really doesn't make a big impact on the agreement between the strains and the model strains and the measured strains. And so it's not clear that this orthotropy model is either if it's capturing this structure or if that element of the mechanics is not their primary function. Again, with advanced stuff with the intersecting fibers, it may be that a continuum model like this is not even the appropriate way to try and describe these this tissue architecture. And finally, they must be there for a reason. I thought Alistair made an interesting comment. They improve the efficacy of model defibrillation. That's a very interesting finding. I doubt that's why they're there. of course, Teo's idea of minimizing wall stress, I think, is an important one as well. And who knows if there's something else. My wife always tells me to remember. Whenever I tell her, I think we've figured out something with these, she's like, of course, that's how the way it would be. I need to ask her these questions before I try and come up with the answer, I guess. Actually, it was kind of funny when I was working for Andrew, my dad came out to visit one time, and I was telling him about some of the stuff we were working on, and he said, let me get this straight. Your thesis, you're studying dog sheep? so back to that's the end of my tissue level issues. I guess I maybe had some residual issues from that. And the idea, so these are the engineers looking at mechanics, right? We can resolve things into sheet architecture, and the idea here is that this is no longer just a basic science kind of thing. You can actually measure the deformations in living patients, and obviously people have spoken quite a bit about that at this meeting. We can then take the strains, use a finite element model to reconstruct the geometry, put in something about the fiber architecture, the material properties, boundary conditions, solve our equations, and predict stresses. And it's like, wow, this is great. We can get something that you just can't measure directly. You also can't validate it, so you have to be careful. And so when we tell the cardiologist about all this wonderful stuff we can do, they say, oh, so it's quantitative and objective. I'll give you that. Comprehensive detailed analysis, certainly detailed. Predictive capability, studying single variables. Yes, you can definitely control things in a way that you can't in experimental models. But of course, it's subject to limitations of the models. Jim Cavell kept me in place by telling me You know, Kevin, no matter what, no matter how good your model is, it's still just a model. It's the experiments that are the truth. And so you have to keep that in mind, and I think he's not the only person with that kind of a point of view. Time, equipment, and labor intensive, some of the other factors that are viewed as features or bugs or whatever you want to call it of cardiac mechanics. And so one of the things that we need to understand is that if we want to have a clinical impact, we need to be able to speak with clinicians and get acceptance of what we're doing. It doesn't mean we stop the other stuff, we just don't try to push it down their throats. So the strategy for increasing clinical impact in cardiac mechanics, number one is to identify some techniques used by cardiologists that are used to evaluate mechanical function. And the two that I'm going to talk about are the pressure-volume relationship in relation to end-systolic elastance, and echocardiography and ventricular wall motion. Then we're going to use these computer models of the heart, not to figure out all the detailed stresses and strains and everything, but try to understand and explore how the engineering analysis can potentially improve some of these techniques. Two example applications. Right, so I mentioned that already. The first one will be the pressure volume stuff, and this is Chris Ingracia's, my student, and Dan Burkoff has been a close collaborator on this work. So, the concept of end-systolic elastance, pressure volume representation of chamber pump function. We have pressure versus volume here, and you see that if you follow in time, the pressure loop, the counterclockwise loops, that that if you change the loading conditions, either the preload or the afterload, it turns out that these loops all fall within these two boundaries, the end-diastolic pressure-volume relationship, which is governed by the passive properties of the tissue, and the end-systolic pressure-volume relationship, shown here, which is a linear, essentially linear relationship, relatively load-independent, and can be reasonably well characterized by the slope of this line, the end-systolic elastance. So this is just an equation for that. It's relatively load independent, and it has two major determinants. One is the intrinsic muscle contractility. If you give this thing some catecholamines or something and increase contractility, you'll see that the slope of this line shifts. If you put in beta blockers or some other thing that's going to, a drug that's going to decrease contractility, then you'll see that the slope of the line decreases. And these are things that can happen acutely to contractility without changing the overall geometry of the tissue. Of course, in long-term processes like heart failure, the cardiomyopathy, where the diameter increases, the wall thickness decreases, and you see that the whole thing is shifted to the right, the slope, the end-systolic elastance decreases. This measure embodies both contractility factors and geometry factors. There's work being done to non-invasively identify or estimate this end-systolic elastance in patients, so potentially this is a clinically useful measure. And the idea is if we can extract out the issues of muscle contractility separately from geometry, then this could impact a physician's decision as to whether what kind of course of treatment for a particular patient. This isn't the first time people have tried to think of this. In fact, Suga and Sagawa, the two that really pushed the pressure volume concept, thought about this normalization scheme, and they came up with a normalization by wall mass. If this is your reference ventricle, if you look at another one, as long as the ratio of the wall thickness to radius maintains constant, then you can actually normalize by the wall mass or the wall volume. Density is about one, so we're going to call it volumes here for convenience. Normalize by wall volume, and you can get a consistent measure, even though the end-systolic elastance on this guy is going to be higher than on this guy, just because this one is a bigger ventricle. If you increase the radius to wall thickness ratio, then this no longer works. It's a good idea in some cases, but it's if this is not, if this condition is not met, it's not an effective normalization scheme. Another approach is Mirsky's idea of looking at end-systolic stress-strain relationship. In mechanics, we know we like to look. It's important to look at stresses and strains because it normalizes for geometry. That's exactly what we're trying to do here. This affects the underlying intrinsic properties of the tissue. And so you can calculate an average stress and an average strain and basically take the ratio of these. There's a scaling factor involved. And this end-systolic myocardial elastance is purported to be a geometry-insensitive measure of end-systolic of muscle contractility. There are studies that show that it's relatively load-independent. It's based on the SSR's distribution curve. And it is from a clinical perspective, the equation is maybe a little more complicated than just multiplying by wall mass. And probably the bigger factor is that the reference for the strain calculation, D0, this is the diameter of the thing in its unloaded configuration. That's not a physiologic configuration. So getting that parameter is difficult to do in patients. Can we come up with another alternative? So the objective of this study was to identify a couple of rational methods for normalizing end-systolic elastins to yield a relatively mass and geometry insensitive index of underlying muscle contractility. And evaluate the performance on these using a modeling approach so that we can have an independent control of contractility and ventricular geometry. This is where the modeling really made possible, sort of in silico experiments that you couldn't do in any other way. There's a lot of stuff here. Basically, this is just the setup of the model we're using. Thanks to Andrew, the continuity software. It's an axisymmetric ellipsoidal model in prolate spheroidal coordinates. So it has a natural elliptical geometry to it, a transmural fiber orientation that's relatively physiologic. We use a transversely isotropic staining, so Guccione's version of the funnel, I guess. 49 model geometry, so we did a range from 15 to 130 mils for the unloaded volume. And we also changed the wall volume from 100 to 300 mils. This kind of encompasses physiologic values for humans, both normal and pathological. We looked at three different levels of muscle contractility. Luckily, Julius went through all the details of these active tension models. I'm not going to do that here. And then we increased the end-systolic elastins to 150 millimeters of mercury. So we loaded this thing up from zero to here, and then we stepped down in the pressure. And the fact that this is a history-independent model of end-systolic mechanics, we didn't have to load up to each one of these. We could just step down insistently. And of course, we confirmed that if we did load up to each one of them, we got the same answer, but it just made the numerical solutions much, much easier to start up here and step down. And then measure pressure and volume at each one of these, fit it with a line, and that gives us end-systolic elastins. We can do this for a normal geometry, which is what you see here. And this is a geometry where we increase the diameter and we decrease the wall thickness. Exactly the same material properties, and as you can see, just changing the geometry impacts the slope of the end-systolic pressure volume relationship. That's what we're trying to account for that effect. So, if we just look at a straight end-systolic elastins and map this to a surface map versus unloaded volume from about 20 to 120 or so mils here, and from wall volume from 100 to 300 mils, so this is the small ventricle and the big ventricles will be out here. And then map end-systolic elastins over the surface, we see there's a very strong dependence on unloaded volume. This is actually in units of millimeters of mercury per mil, so this is the actual elastins value. And what we found that if we're going to do these different normalization schemes, we're going to end up with all kinds of different units. We're not going to be able to compare them easily. So what we did is just take the maximum one for the intermediate level of contractility and normalize by that. And so what you'll be seeing in the next couple of slides is all on the same set of axes here. So we can look at sort of the surface flatness of this landscape as a measure of geometry independence. So that's end-systolic elastins. If we do the wall volume normalization that was suggested, we see that the surface gradient has been decreased. So we can measure the flatness of this by the gradient of the normalized and scaled elastins. It's decreased a little bit, but not by much. It's pulled this corner down, but this corner is still high. And what ends up seeing is if you follow the constant color boundaries on the surface, those are edges of constant R over H. That's when this normalization scheme works. So when you go from this corner to this corner, it's pretty decent. When you go from this corner to this corner, obviously it is not R over H is not preserved, and this normalization doesn't work. So, motivated by the shape of the original curve, this is the original end-systolic elastins curve, again, the one I showed you two slides ago, what we saw was that there was a strong dependence on unloaded volume. So what if we scale instead our elastins by unloaded volume? And we see that now we have a surface that looks like this. It's much flatter. The gradients are actually the smallest ones we found of the normalization schemes I'm going to present to you today. The difficulty with this is that, like the unloaded diameter, the unloaded volume is a difficult thing to measure accurately
physiologically. When you try and estimate from that systolic pressure volume relationship, sometimes you get negative numbers. And if you try to estimate it from the passive properties, the passive curve comes in at a very low slope. It's really hard to identify when it hits the zero pressure axis. So that's a hard, well, based on the model result, it seems like if we could do that, that would be a very beneficial thing. And if, you know, there's some efforts put into maybe identifying that more accurately, that might be useful. But at the present time, this would probably not be a very effective approach. Remember end-systolic elastance times V-wall? This is it again. And when you look at this, I was telling you that in one direction, in one diagonal, it kind of works, and the other diagonal, it fails miserably. How does it fail? It turns out that the contractility index, the contractility is highest when you have, let's see, when you have a small, thick-walled ventricle. So when you have a small R over H, and when you have a large R over H, which is in this corner, you have a small contractility index. So this gives the idea that this is sort of consistent with the idea that if you're remodeling in a way that is preserving R over H, then your contractility index should be constant. If you're not preserving that, then your contractility index gets messed up. And so what if we scale this guy by R over H? Right? When this is big, R over H is small. When this is small, R over H is big. So just scale it by that factor. And it pops this end up, pushes this end down, and doesn't really affect things in this direction. And we get something that's more, that's flatter. It's not the best one that we had, but it's better than the standard normalization by wall volume. And the nice thing is that R over H are much easier to measure with echo than unloaded volumes. Just a quick summary of these different schemes. This is the unscaled elastance. This is by V wall, multiplying by unloaded volume. This is the one I just showed you. Wall volume plus the R of H factor. This is myocardial elastance. This was in the second slide that I showed you there, where we're trying to calculate the slope of the end-systolic stress-strain relationship. This is the one that should ideally be uniform for all of the geometries. And what I've done here is on the vertical axis, this is the relative index value. So we call the normal guy. We selected five different geometries representing normal diastolic heart failure, systolic heart failure. A relatively non-physiologic, largely dilated geometry, but just kind of filled in the parameter space, and then sort of a mid-range geometry. This is a lot to read, but I'll point out a couple of things to you in a moment here. So everything is normalized by the value for the normal chamber. Okay, so everything's relative to normal, we're calling that one. And if everything is nice and uniform across, that would mean a good index of contractility that's independent of geometry. If things are going all over the place, then obviously it's not compensating for wall geometry. We see the V wall, this one and this one are pretty good, right? The black one here, which is normal, and systolic heart failure. When we look at this, normal R of H is 1.1, systolic heart failure is 1.17. They're pretty close. So like we said, that scheme works if R of H is constant. But when you have big swings in R of H, you get big swings in this contractility index. Normalizing by unloaded volume, we get something that's pretty nice. When we normalize by the R over H factor, it's not as good as the unloaded volume, but it's not any worse than what, you know, would be considered by most to be the gold standard, which is the stress strain based one. And so we actually selected this one as a new normalization scheme that actually might be relatively geometry independent. There's one caveat with this. Which is scaling by R over H. How do you decide when to measure R over H? In our model, we sent everything to 150 millimeters of mercury to start off with, and so we chose that value for normalization. If you're going to apply this to a patient, you can't guarantee that there's any particular reference pressure that you can say, we're going to measure the patient's R over H at this pressure. So we tried to come up with a way to account for that. Here, I'm measuring R of H is a function of end-systolic pressure for the five different hearts that I just showed you on the previous slide. Let's just take one of them for example. You see that basically the increase in R of H is linearly increasing with pressure. Okay? And the other thing that's important to notice about this is that if you start off with a bigger heart, a bigger R of H, you have a steeper slope. Okay? It's a lot easier to inflate a big thin vessel than it is a small thick vessel. And the reason that's important is because That means if these are if the slope is proportional to the intercept, you can choose some reference pressure, any pressure you want, like we were doing with the 150 millimeters of mercury, and normalize by that value. And all of these curves end up collapsing onto a single line. I'm only showing you this for the intermediate contractility, but for the high and the low contractility values, they also collapse onto this line. And so what that means is there's this master curve that describes the relative normalized R of H value relative to asystolic pressure. And so what that allows you to do is, this is the equation for this line. We have n systolic divided by the reference is just some linear function of pressure. So our new index now, instead of elastids times wall times this reference pressure, because we can't get all the patients at this reference pressure, instead we just solve this equation, and reference pressure is this divided by this. And so we have n systolic elastins times V wall times the patient's own n systolic R of H divided by this A plus B master curve things times the patient's own asystolic pressure. Okay, we don't know if this is going to work. Of course, this all has to be validated in patients or in animals or something, but the model is suggesting this might be an approach. So, validation. It's a new method, and it requires careful experimental validation. We're currently working with Dan in some of his animal studies and human patient data to validate this, and that shouldn't have come up on its own like that. It would benefit from an experimental system with independent control of chamber geometry and myocyte contractility. There's no experimental system that currently gives you that capability. And so one of the things that we've done is engineer a myocyte, so this is neonatal rat cardiac myocytes in a collagen gel that's in the shape of a chamber that, as you can see, it kind of swims around in a dish. It gives you independent control of the geometry and the muscle properties. Calling it our engineered cardiac organoid. You can hook it up to a little pressure catheter like this, just tie it on there. It's about a centimeter across, about 400 microns in diameter. There's a random distribution of myocytes in the wall. It beats, I showed it to you slowed down, that was with a high speed camera. It beats at around 4 hertz. And when we hook it up to our little Langendorf system, we can measure area changes, we can measure pressures, we can measure electrophysiology, and we think that this may be a system that we can develop for one application is to test these kind of things where you can have a level of control of the experimental system, long-term culture, that you can't do with any isolated heart preparation. So the conclusions here, that the common method of end-systolic elastance times V wall, very dependent on LV geometry. It's not something that you'd want to rely on for making any kind of decisions about patient care. Maybe the unloaded scaling is a better approach, but this is a difficult thing to measure clinically, so again, efforts to try and make that more accurate would be helpful. Calculations of end-systolic myocardial stiffness may not be as geometry independent as believed, so that idea of based on the calculation of the end-systolic stress strain curve, of course, in principle, that should be a measure of the contractility, but the equations that are used make assumptions that maybe aren't quite right, and it turns out that our new index is no worse than this one, at least for the model test cases that we looked at here. And so this is an example of the practical utility of these model-based approaches that are still awaiting experimental validation. So that was the one example about the pressure volume test. The other one that when you talk to cardiologists, what are they doing to evaluate heart function? Stress echo, right? Echocardiography looking at endocardial wall motion. This is a project, and in fact, the idea for this really, Jeff Holmes is the one that came up with the original idea for this approach, and we've been working together on focusing on some of the modeling aspects of this. We've been working together with Nick Holm, a cardiologist, and then Chris and Susan, our students in the lab. So, clinical evaluation of wall motion, echocardiography is widely used and accepted clinically. Safe, cost-effective, portable. I didn't see a couple of the talks on Monday, so maybe this is all review. Basically, echo is clinically accepted and widely used, even more so than MRI, because it's more cost effective. You don't have to put the person inside the tube. You can just go up and measure the function. And so there's a lot of potential advantages for including stress tests. When you do either exercise or Doguni stress tests, you potentially can find at-risk myocardium because you can increase the metabolic demand on the heart and then monitor it with echo in real time and see if there are regions where the wall motion is becoming altered. And that might be a region that's at risk for a heart attack. And that's exactly the kind of thing that clinicians want to know is if something is going to happen before it happens, because then they can intervene and hopefully help the patient. So
what do these echoes look like? He has two examples, actually somewhat enhanced here. When you look at something like this, this is what the clinicians are looking at. When Ellen McVeigh gave a talk at BMES in the fall on some MR stuff, he referred to being able to read these as the cardiology shamans that can look at these and kind of figure out where the infarcts are and what exactly is the, which one is the normal one, and looks like this. This is anterior wall MI, there's something going on up here. But what fraction of the wall is involved? How much is it? Is it an old infarct? Is it a new infarct? If we could identify those kinds of things from these images, that would be a huge clinical benefit. So currently, wall motion analysis is subjective evaluation. There's considerable variability among trained clinicians. Roughly 80% intra clinic, and between clinics, it can be as low as like 40%, depending on the study that you're referencing. Largely qualitative analysis. So it limits evaluation of treatment of longitudinal progression of the disease. Difficult to evaluate without accepted independent gold standard. And qualitative measures are considered too. Quantitative measures are considered very, very labor intensive. What kind of quantitative measures are we talking about here? It's the segmental wall motion analysis is the most common. You draw a line, or not you, the cardiologist is, like you said, if you take more than 5 minutes, they're not interested. They have to draw a line on this, make a bunch of radial segments. This is the boundary at end diastole. This is, inner one is the boundary at end systole, and you measure how much deformation there is along these radial trajectories from end diastole to end systole, and this is called a fractional shortening. So what are the things that are limiting two-dimensional wall motion analysis by these approaches? There's three main factors. One is the automatic segmentation. We're working with Andrew Lane at Columbia University to develop some automatic segmentation routines for this, but I'm not going to talk about that today. Any method of defining a centroid for one for the end diastolic versus the end systolic image, those centroid those centroid identification techniques can introduce error by biasing where you position, how you align the end diastolic and end systolic boundaries. And of course, imaging the entire ventricle requires reconstructing things from a two-dimensional view that we scan over the ventricle. And so one of the main advances now is this 3D real-time ultrasound that solves the centroid and the reconstruction problem because everything's acquired in one shot. And it may facilitate some of the segmentation. Like I said, we're working on that problem. And this is an example from the Philips website of this. This is a system that we're using, and you can see the valves and stuff here. And this is a one-shot deal where there's an array of ultrasound transducers, and you get the full 3D anatomy without having to move around. So the objective of this study was to improve the detection and diagnosis of heart disease through an engineering analysis of ventricular wall motion. Can we identify some novel approaches for parameterizing wall motion on an elliptical polar coordinate system? So again, we're going to make use of the prolate spheroidal coordinates to efficiently represent the geometry in space and time. This is the idea. It's relatively simple. Let's assume that this is a cross-section of the ventricle in the short axis, at end diastole, and at end systole, if everything's happy and symmetric, it all goes in, and you get uniform contraction. And if you want to represent this in a Cartesian coordinate system, then you have the circle that's decreasing with time. What we're doing is looking for abnormalities in this behavior, and so the fact that you're starting off with something that's kind of curved makes this problem more difficult. If we do this in polar coordinates and radial coordinates, you end up with a radius that's uniform around theta and decreases with time. Finding an anomaly in something like this, we think, might be easier to do than finding an anomaly in something like this. And so here's an anomaly. It doesn't contract here, it does contract here, and when we look at this in radial coordinates, you see this little bump. And so whether you actually look for the bump or you look at gradients in the surface in the radial coordinate or gradients in time, there's a number of different things that you can do with a data set like this. But first we wanted to see whether, in fact, this parameterization looks promising. But that's sort of the general idea. If you don't get that, stop now, because then you will sort of miss the rest. Okay? That's pretty straightforward, okay? So prolate spheroidal anatomy, again, we're doing these elliptical geometry. We want a concise representation of wall motion, so we're going to use these prolate spheroidal coordinates. We project the endocardial surface points that are digitized from ultrasound onto the underform mesh,
And then we, instead of having to fit things in XYZ, we use Paul Nielsen's approach to prescribe the mu and theta coordinates that only fit the radial coordinate, project along the radial axis onto this ellipsoidal mesh. And then this reduces to a very quick one-dimensional fitting procedure. And with a small number of higher elements, we can get a concise representation of the endocardial wall. Here's our 3D echo, some multiple slices. We've done some hand tracing here, and we end up with a data set that gives us about 15,000 numbers. It's the 5,000 points from about 16 radial long axis and 16 to 20 short axis slices. We get about 15,000 numbers, and when we do this fitting procedure with 72 nodes from 64 elements, we end up with 288 numbers describing the same data set. So it's a more concise representation of the parameter of the boundary. And then we want to extend this instead of just fitting this at a given time point, fitting the surface. We want to be able to fit this in time as well. We think that by fitting in four dimensions, the fact that you saw what those echoes look like. You're trying to digitize those things by hand, there's going to be a lot of digitizing error. But the fact is, some point on the endocardial surface has to be moving continuously in time. And if you can do the fitting, take advantage of the continuity in time as well as the continuity in space, then maybe you can reduce noise and also give us additional measures that we can look at, like velocities of the endocardial wall velocity instead of just positions. So anyway, that's the rationale. Obtain degrees of freedom. That we're designating delta here, which best describe the dynamic LV endocardium. Each spatiotemporal point, so we've got data points in x, y, z, and time, is represented by lambda. We don't have to worry about mu and theta anymore because that was, I explained that in the previous slide. This is represented by lambda in the three finite element coordinates, or the three normalized coordinates within each element of the surface. We use these generalized tensor product basis functions. They meet basis functions in the plane of the wall. This is smooth basis functions that include derivatives so that we have C1 continuity over the surface. We get nice smooth surfaces instead of funny cusps at the element boundaries. And then we use a polynomial Lagrange basis for the time dependence. Construct the stiffness matrix. And then we have n data points and m degrees of freedom in our model. And as long as we have the number of data points much bigger than the number of degrees of freedom, we can calculate the pseudo inverse, and this is effectively a least squares minimization problem, and we can figure out what the fitted coordinates of the surface are. And here's an example of two locations on our fitted surface. This is from a 4D fit now, and what we're looking at is what the lambda coordinate was for the individual fitting just in space at the individual time points. That's what the dots are. And then from this actual 4D fit, and we see that we have a nice agreement just using a cubic Lagrange interpolation in time. Elliot and Bill Hunter had done some work doing mechanoelectric, some pacing work and mechanoelectric contraction, and they mentioned like a seventh order polynomial to look at the time dependence. I guess with MRI you have a higher temporal resolution, perhaps. We looked at a bunch of different ones and did a convergence analysis, and we found that the cubic, at least for this data set, was adequate. This is not model data, by the way. This is actual data from a dog. The model is what gives us the smooth line here. And actually, I guess the model is giving us the points as well. But it's not like we did a simulation of the contraction like we did for the pressure volume stuff. This is actually just using the model to parameterize the boundary data. All right. So we extend the fitting process to true 4D. Minimize digitizing errors. We're expressing these as mu theta in time now. And this allows us to do things like not only measure curvatures, but also rates of motion. And the temporal resolution appears to be sufficient to detect some mechanical asynchrony. In other words, there are some times where we can find a minimum at one part of the heart that isn't at the same time as a minimum at another part of the heart. Radial wall motion, the thickening, changes in curvature, all these different potential measures are things that we could devise as ways of identifying the ischemic region. So we need to formulate measures based on this knowledge and an understanding of what we think cardiologists are actually perceiving when they magically come up with a measure of where the infarct is located and how big it is, etc. So we'll screen these candidate measures for sensitivity using our finite element model. I'll also describe a model of the ischemic heart that we got from Andrew and Reza Mazari, and then field test any promising measures on actual M1 patient data. Here's the model that's available on the UCSD website. This is a 3D finite element model of acutely ischemic canine left ventricle, it's got all the stuff that it needs to have. It's like the latest stuff from the UCSD group, including transverse fiber active tension. So it's the passive term, active term along the fiber, and the active term perpendicular to the fiber axis. In this study, they actually measured the perfusion boundary in these dogs, map that onto the three-dimensional left ventricle model. If this is the perfusion boundary, they looked at blood flow to figure out what was ischemic and what was not ischemic, turned this into a nodal field variable, and when this field variable is greater than zero, there's just an abrupt cutoff on the ischemic boundary. If the field variable on the upside of the boundary is greater than zero, if it's on the outside of the boundary, it's greater than zero, right? The boundary is the cutoff of where this field variable goes from positive to negative values. When they're positive values, it's acting normally. When they're negative values, that the contractility has been reduced. To simulate the local ischemia. And then we can control the size of this infarct by simply shifting this perfusion, the infarct boundary left or right. And the measure that we're going to present is this three-dimensional fractional shortening. It's the lambda, or the radial coordinate at end diastole, minus the value at the corresponding point on the surface at end systole, normalized by the end diastolic value. And we needed to rank these in some way. There's not a lot of rankings for this kind of level of detail, but there is a measure of hypokinesis, American Society of Echocardiography. There are 2D ultrasound segmental wall motion analysis for fractional shortening. If it's below 0.25, then it's hypokinetic. If it's above, then it's normal. So we use that cutoff also for normal and hypokinetic. Akinetic is just something that's roughly zero. And then dyskinetic, or actually bulging, going in the wrong direction, happens when you have large negative 3D fractional shortening. So here's an example of the model. There's a wireframe, which is end diastole. The shaded surface is end systole. And so you can see in the normal case, everything moves in, right? We can move in the radial direction. And we see that our map is all basically normal. There's no akinesis and there's no dyskinesis. When we make a big old infarct here, you see that at end systole, it's actually bulging out past the end diastolic wireframe. So this is the active region. The inactive region, when we do our hammer map, we see that there's a big dyskinesis around the apex. It's bordered by this akinetic region, and then there's hypokinesis or normal function above that. And this is mapped onto the correct region near the apex where the infarct was located. These hammer maps are kind of like splaying open a world map with the constraint that relative areas are maintained in this mapping, so that you don't get a giant Antarctica down here. You actually, the apex maps onto a point. And so here's our model of LAD occlusion, finite element model of LAD occlusion. This is with an ischemic area fraction. So this is 43% of the endocardial area was rendered ischemic. This is the finite element model, and this is the mapping of the three-dimensional fractional shortening. And then we could adjust this, 31%, 10%, and you can see that the amount of abnormal wall motion is decreasing. And so we can just plot this now it's kind of hard to see. There's actually a boundary here. This is this is the akinetic area fraction, the light one, akinesis, which initially for a small infarct kind of bumps up, but then it remains actually relatively constant for larger infarcts. So this is increasing infarct size. This is increasing fraction of the surface that's involved. that's not normally moving normally. So the akinesis kind of levels off. The dyskinesis increases, but the slope, and it doesn't equal the line of unity. But when you add the two together, the total amount of non-normal motion actually seems to be a pretty good predictor of ischemic area fraction, with the caveat that there are some small infarcts here that would be tough to detect. This is for a circumflex, left circumflex occlusion. Now we're getting an ischemic region up near the base. Same. This is also based on the validated with the experiments that Andrew and his team had done. Validating meaning they're matching strains, they're matching the boundary of the ischemic region. Obviously, this hadn't been validated against wall motion because we hadn't used it for wall motion before. This is what we're doing for the first time here. Change the area size, ischemic area size, and we see that the decrease involved region. And so this is the graph I showed you a second ago. This is the corresponding graph of the circumflex occlusion. And again, what we're seeing is that the endocardial area fraction with normal fractional shortening is a realistic predictor of simulated ischemic region size. It's detectable by three-dimensional fractional shortening, 5 to 10 detectable by, I'm sorry, the threshold is about 5 to 10%. So where this chops off here, this is consistent with what people see qualitatively in patients using echo. There are some small infarcts that you just can't tell. They're not big enough to impact wall motion. And so we're seeing that there's sort of a limit there as well. And so we think that these are relatively good candidates then for animal or clinical testing. We've done a little bit of this validation. It's not really extensive at this stage, but this is our 3D echo of an open chest dog heart, short axis and four chamber view. And when we do 3D fractional shortening, this is with experimental circumflex occlusion for 5 minutes. And we see that there was some abnormal wall motion down near the apex in the region that we think was being being supplied by the circumflex. And when we do our circumflex model, where we adjusted the location of the infarct in our model and adjusted the hemodynamics that were consistent with what we measured in the experiment, we see that there's reasonable correspondence between our model prediction for fractional shortening and our measured fractional shortening. In this experiment, we did circumflex, LAD occlusion, again, and control conditions. The top row is what we measured experimentally. The bottom is our best estimate of a model simulation of that same experiment. And you can see that the general patterns are pretty consistent. We see a little more hypokinesis here in our model than we measured experimentally, but it's not until you see these dark regions that are considered abnormal motion. And we did have one patient study as well. We're at rest. You don't see any abnormal motion. This was a dobutamine stress test, and you see that there's weird bulging effects on the endocardium, and we see some regions of abnormal motion. Of course, validating these studies is difficult. We don't always know. These are very complicated patient histories typically. There's not necessarily just one, clearly defined infarct in these patients. But the idea is that there were, the cardiologist identified this as somebody who was at risk in the stress test, and we were able to pick up some abnormal motion under dobutamine conditions as well. So that was all 3D fractional shortening, and what I want to leave you with for the last slide here is that 3D fractional shortening may be one measure that can be used to identify a region of abnormal wall motion. But because we have this four-dimensional parameterization of the ventricular of the endocardium, maybe there are other things that we could take advantage of. Maybe there are other measures. In particular, an experimental study from Dr. Cavell's lab looking at acute ischemia in dogs, when you look at this is an example of longitudinal strain. Longitudinal strain in the dog, during systole, it contracts, right? It's shortening. And then during diastole, it's lengthening again. So that's what this is showing, control, shortening longitudinally, and then relaxing. In ischemia, it's not contracting. And in fact, when the rest of the muscle is contracting, the ischemic region is getting stretched. And so what you see here is paradoxical stretching during systole. And eventually, it does contract as well, but it's been delayed, and you never actually get shortening in this case. So you see opposite motion in ischemia is what you do in control. This is for longitudinal shortening. When we look at the time course of our computer model of circumflex occlusion fit to the canine, this was to the canine circumflex data that I showed you a moment ago. fully 4D fit now. If we look at our lambda, our radial coordinate as a function of frame number here, but as a function of time, basically, from end diastole to, I don't think it quite gets back to end diastole here. Maybe it does, actually. what we see is that in the control conditions, lambda decreases and then goes back up. So it's contracting inwards. When you do some ischemia, we see that in this region we're actually getting bulging, lambda's getting bigger instead of smaller, and it's sort of similar to the patterns that we see in the animals with measuring strain. So this is just from radial motion, but we get similar kinds of patterns here. And so what kind of things can we extract from this data set? Of course we can get fractional shortening. This is end diastole, and we can define end systole and get this measure. We could also do something like, how long does it take to get to the minimum lambda value? Here, it happens quicker in the healthy region, and it takes longer to get to the minimum value in the ischemic region. And if we plot that on our grayscale, then again, we see that it takes longest to reach a minimum value in the affected region here. And then finally, we can take advantage of something like the temporal continuity and take derivatives of lambda with respect to time. And that's what we're mapping in this guy here. It turns out that if we had any, so during isovolumic contraction, this early part of systole, if you're normal, d lambda dt should be negative. It should be decreasing. And if it was decreasing, then we just painted it white. If it was increasing, if it was positive at all, then we want to know how positive it was. We scale that on this grayscale. And anything that is positive would be paradoxical motion of the wall during systole, and would be indicative of ischemia. And in fact, we see that this map here is perhaps more specific for ischemic region than the other two maps that we saw. So again, we don't have an independent measure of how much of the wall was ischemic, but we think that this shows promise at least for alternative measures that you wouldn't have if you didn't have that 4D fit. Conclusions, the wall motion is a qualitative but clinically proven measure of regional function. So quantifying wall motion is likely to provide clinically useful information. It's already accepted by the clinicians. The advent of real-time 3D ultrasound has improved the reliability and availability of stress imaging, with simultaneously allowing robust solutions to traditional problems with quantitative wall motion analysis. So there's registration problems and things like this. It's not an issue with 3D ultrasound, 3D real-time ultrasound. So some methods for four-dimensional parameterization of the endocardial surface have been developed, and we're designing and testing qualitative wall motion measures. This is ongoing, screening some other potential measures. And then the model simulation suggests that 3D fractional shortening should be able to predict ischemic region size, and preliminary experimental and clinical studies have been encouraging. Perhaps including a fully 4D analysis would further enhance our detection of ischemia and also open up other applications such as ventricular resynchronization, where you might be able to detect regions that are contracting based on the wall motion and understand the electrical disynchrony. And so take-home messages, the one for the tissue level issues: the laminar architecture of myocardium is complex and detailed functional mechanisms remain elusive, but it seems to play a role in enhancing translation of myocyte shortening to wall thickening. They're there for a reason. I don't know if we quite understand it yet, but it's clear that they seem to be important. And then for a second portion of the talk, finite element modeling and mechanical analysis can be used to simulate clinically familiar functional tests and explore new measures of cardiac performance to facilitate translation to clinical practice. The idea that we can use these models not just for the fantastic stress and strain solutions that they can give us, but also as the best that we have as a computational model of how the heart functions, and use those to examine some clinically relevant measures. These are the folks that have been more directly involved with these studies: cardiac biomechanics group, Susan and Chris. Dave Hamming was a master's student working on some of this work. Todd's a clinical fellow that was doing some of the tracings and identifying the echo. Of course, Jeff is a close collaborator on all of this work, and again, he came up with the idea of the four-dimensional wall motion analysis. And Nick Homa is the cardiologist who we've been working with on this project. Elsa is a PhD student; she's now a faculty in Paris that was working for Andrew Lane and helped with some of the segmentation issues that we've been dealing with to try and track the endocardial boundary and using techniques like optical flow to minimize user input. We've got a technique now where you can define the endochondral boundary and the diastolic and systolic, and use optical flow to do everything else in between. So that can really cut down on the amount of time that the cardiologists have to spend on with these data sets. Dan is a cardiologist that also is helping with the pressure volume stuff. Funding from NSF, Susan had an individual fellowship from the Lewis Moore Fellowship, and of course, thanks to Andrew for allowing us to use the finite element code. And that's it.